questions that will be discussed over the course of this session. It is also a sign of the importance, I would say, that states and NGOs attach to the Human Rights Council as a venue to discuss issues which are often not heard in other venues. So it's incredibly significant.
This year marks 75 years since the adoption of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and 30 years since the adoption of the Vienna Declaration, two milestone documents that continue to guide the work of the Council. But it is very clear that we still have a long way to go.
The 52nd session of the Human Rights Council started on February 27th and will continue until April the 4th. Key issues on the agenda include the three Ps: promotion, protection, and prevention. Promotion of human rights, protection of those who fight for human rights, and preventing human rights from being violated. Gisoum Shahmadi, the Human Rights Headquarters in Geneva.
Years after Brexit, they're still talking about it. One big sticking point, the post-Brexit Northern Ireland Protocol for Trade, legislation that at one point threatened the Good Friday Peace Agreement and pushed the EU and UK to the brink of a trade war. Officials on both sides of the dispute now claim they have found a solution to the problem, and they have a name for it too.
The Windsor Framework delivers free-flowing trade within the whole United Kingdom. It protects Northern Ireland's place in our union, and it safeguards sovereignty for the people of Northern Ireland.
Under the New Deal, there will be two routes for goods entering Northern Ireland from the rest of the UK. A green route with minimal checks for goods, which will stay in Northern Ireland, and a red one for goods which may continue into the EU after going through EU checks. Disputes will be settled by Northern Ireland courts, but some could still go to the European Court of Justice. And if new EU single market regulations are introduced, the UK government could veto them if the Northern Ireland Assembly has voted for that to happen.
We are now seeing part of the United Kingdom, namely the north of Ireland, essentially being re-invited back into aspects of the EU. And that is a very big statement. And I'm sure that Brussels is hoping this will begin to disintegrate the overall Brexit deal.
The details of the deal are yet to emerge, but Prime Minister Sunak faces two challenges. One is to get the approval of the Democratic Unionists in Northern Ireland, who have refused to enter a power-sharing government with Sinn Féin nationalists for months over the Boris Johnson-era protocol, which has created a sea border between Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK.
The unionists have a set of tests that have to be passed or they'll back out of it. Now, that's an insurance policy. They don't want to lose votes. They don't want to look like they've sold out the unionist agenda. And that makes political sense for them. The big test for Sunak, more than anything else, is whether he can get all sides to give a tick in the box.
In Westminster, meantime, the Prime Minister has briefed his cabinet, who seem to be on side.
The Prime Minister's next challenge would be winning the approval of the Eurosceptic Conservative members of the ERG, the European Research Group in the building behind me, who have already said that the revised bill does not go far enough, which means that the deal is not quite done yet. Saeed Bourizza, London.
The indefinite strike, which began nationwide on January 4th in protest at the Dina Boluarte administration, remains strong in the southern regions of Peru, with major road closures in several provinces, according to the Ground Transport Authority. Nearly all of the civilians that have been reported killed since the December 7th ouster of President Castillo lost their lives in anti-government protests in this part of the country.
It's mainly the people in the countryside who are mistreated. We cry daily for our sons who have been killed, as many as 70 people by this government, and they still haven't acknowledged that they did it. They haven't said who was killed.
A newly released Ipsos poll finds that nationally, 51% of Peruvians believe that Pedro Castillo was ousted in a parliamentary coup, a number which surges to 69% in rural areas like here in the Puno region.
Particularly in Puno, they have marginalized us a lot. They have said that we are terrorists, that we are vandals, and that we are just Indians. We are going to continue fighting. I believe the strike will continue until Dina Boluarte resigns, as well as the rest of the Congress.
A preliminary report released this week by the International Human Rights and Solidarity Mission outlines numerous human rights abuses and calls for an investigation of the Peruvian state for crimes against humanity, for its excessive use of force against a defenseless civilian population and using lethal weapons.
I want justice to be served and for the whole world to find out everything that we are going through here. I want everyone to know so that there is justice for our children who have died.
Around the country, the popular call continues to be the demand for the resignation of Dina Boluarte, as well as immediate presidential elections. Camila Escalante, Desaguadero.
Consumer Association Federconsumatori has rung the alarm bell over the growing financial difficulties Italian families are faced with. Federconsumatori National Observatory has found that one out of four families in Italy is struggling to cope with high inflation and rising cost of living. This, as the Bureau of Statistics Istat has estimated a timid comeback in consumer confidence in February. According to Federconsumatori, an increasing number of Italians are giving up on food quality to save money.
Today, as the cost of living crisis has eroded families' purchasing power, we have recorded a 17% drop in the purchase of meat and fish and a 13% drop in the consumption of fruit and vegetables. We had asked the government to introduce significant supporting measures for the Italian families, but unfortunately our calls went utterly unheard.
Prices in Italy rose more than 8% year on year in 2022, jumping to its highest 12-month gain in nearly 40 years when the lira currency was in use. According to Istat, Italy's annual inflation rate registered a slowdown in January, dropping to 10% from 11.6% in December. However, the situation has turned dire for many in the country.
The cost of living went up big way, too much for a young student like me. Prices have doubled over the past months.
The cost of staple food items, basic ingredients, has gone crazy, and also the cost of energy. To me, it's a theft by the government.
According to analysts, high energy prices have been the main drivers for the bulk of those increases, pushed higher by the energy supply challenges that followed the Ukraine-Russia war. The poverty rate increased significantly in Italy in 2020-2022 period. In 2021, some 2 million families lived in absolute poverty, a figure accounting for over 5.5 million people that is destined to grow. Max Civili, Rome.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
Officials of Yemen's Ansar Allah movement have emphasized that the United States and Britain are trying to continue the aggression and siege of Yemen and prevent any meaningful peace being achieved in the country. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. website of Press TV has covered this story and tells us more. The Foreign Ministry of Yemen's National Salvation Government has severely censured the United Kingdom over its criminal approach towards the impoverished and war-wracked Arab country, stating that its policies have led to the serious deterioration of the Yemeni people's sufferings as it torpedoes any attempt aimed at establishing a nationwide peace. The Yemeni Foreign Ministry said in a statement that London is involved in everyday hostilities being committed against the Yemeni nation and stands brazenly on the side of Saudi-backed thieves and terrorists who were deposed by the Yemeni people. It stressed that the latest remarks by British Ambassador to Yemen, Richard Oppenheim, clearly attest to London's criminal role in exacerbating the suffering of the Yemeni people and explicitly shows that Britain is chiefly accountable for the maximum pressure campaign against Yemen, the blockade of Yemen, and the starvation of the Yemeni people. The statement pointed out that the British ambassador to Sana'a, Richard Oppenheim's comments, have brought shame on all Britons and acknowledged Britain is engaged in war crimes being committed against the Yemeni people. It read, "These crimes, which are being committed without any reservations, give the Yemeni nation the full right to pursue and punish British officials through all available legal channels." The head and deputy head of Yemen's so-called Presidential Leadership Council reviewed the current situation in the country in a meeting with Richard Oppenheim in the Saudi capital Riyadh on 10th of January. The Presidential Leadership Council chairman, Rashad Al-Alami, briefed the British ambassador to Yemen on retaliatory attacks on oil facilities and what he claimed the implications of these attacks on the humanitarian and economic situation in the country. Richard Oppenheim said Britain supports the Saudi-backed government of Yemen and claimed the coordination of so-called efforts to ensure that 2023 is a year of peace for the Yemeni people. The Yemeni Foreign Ministry stressed that Britain is apparently prolonging the Yemeni war, further deteriorating the miseries of the Yemeni people, impeding peace efforts and resuming vicious military assault. It held Britain, the United States of America and their allies fully responsible for the status quo in Yemen and warned against the rise of tensions in the country. The ministry finally called on the United Nations and all freedom-loving people of the world to condemn Britain's flagrant intervention in Yemen's domestic affairs, which significantly obstructs restoration of peace in Yemen. The statement underlined the need for a balanced and thorough assessment of the economic situation in Yemen and effective measures to address the suffering of the Yemeni people. The English website of the Yemeni broadcaster Al Mayadeen television network has also covered the same story. The Sana'a government's Prime Minister Abdulaziz bin Habtour said on Saturday, 21st of January, Britain cannot have a hand in alleviating the economic suffering of the Yemeni people, explaining that Britain is a main party to the aggression in Yemen. The Yemeni Prime Minister told Al Masira television channel, "The United Kingdom, through the multilateral agreement, will not give a single pound to ensure the success of the former mercenary regime's proposals," adding, "It is going through an economic crisis and looking towards others for help." He said, "The United Kingdom is still this day a main party to the aggression in Yemen in terms of planning and execution. London is the protector of the former regime of mercenaries." Prime Minister Abdulaziz bin Habtour underlined, "The British ambassador's recent statements are irresponsible. The former mercenary regime's decision to raise the price of the customs dollar rate is directed, in this circumstance, against the entire Yemeni people." It is noteworthy that Britain supported the measure in question, which was met with condemnation from Yemen as an extension of the blockade imposed on the country by the West and by the Saudi-led coalition of aggression. The British ambassador to Sana'a said the United Kingdom supports the economic measure implemented by the former mercenary regime, holding the Ansar Allah movement responsible for the humanitarian situation in the country. This claim comes as the United States and Britain have been imposing a stifling air, land and sea blockade on Yemen. The Prime Minister of Yemen said the British ambassador's statements publicly revealed the criminal role played by London in exacerbating the suffering of the Yemeni people. Prime Minister Abdulaziz bin Habtour added, "The statements in question prove that London stands behind the economic warfare, including the policies of blockade and starvation." The Associated Press has also covered the same story. A new report said recently weapons supplied by the United Kingdom and the United States to the Saudi-led coalition in war-torn Yemen killed at least 839 civilians and wounded 1,775 others in just over a year. The report by the charity Oxfam revealed that the Saudi-led coalition used weapons supplied solely by Britain and the United States in hundreds of attacks targeting innocent civilians in Yemen between January of 2021 and the end of February 2022. The 43-page Oxfam report, authored by Martin Butcher, Oxfam's policy advisor on arms and conflict, stated that an analysis of attacks showed that the Saudi-led forces used Western-supplied weapons in hundreds of relentless attacks against civilian targets in Yemen during this 14-month period. According to the report, of all the attacks by the Saudi-led coalition during the 14-month period, from January of 2021 through to February of 2022, airstrikes alone killed at least 87 civilians and wounded 136 others. The coalition attacks, 19 of which targeted medical institutions and ambulances, during this period included airstrikes by jet fighters as well as artillery attacks, missile attacks and drone attacks, in addition to casualties from landmines, road bombs and light arms. Martin Butcher, Oxfam's policy advisor on arms and conflict, said, "It's just so relentless. People just find it so hard to escape the violence and the killing in Yemen." The report also found that in the attacks, the coalition used Western-made cluster munitions, weapons banned by international convention and customary law. Martin Butcher called on Western governments, particularly the United States of America and Britain, to immediately cease arms sales to Saudi Arabia for use in Yemen and to promote a permanent ceasefire and negotiations for a long-term settlement through his position as a member of the United Nations Security Council. Martin Butcher said, "The government's really been not only arming Saudi Arabia, but also very reluctant to use their position in the UN Security Council to push for peace in Yemen. The United States of America and Britain are the main suppliers of weapons to Saudi Arabia, selling tens of billions of dollars worth of arms to Riyadh. For decades, Saudi authorities have been the lead importers of American-made and British-manufactured weapons. Saudi Arabia, in collaboration with its Arab allies and with arms and logistics support from the United States and Britain and various other Western countries, has launched a devastating war in Yemen in March of 2015. The objective of the war was to crush the Ansar Allah movement, which has been running the country in the absence of a functioning government, and to reinstall the Riyadh-friendly, unpopular regime of Abdurrabbu Mansur Hadi."
on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, Thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
Sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. Iran and Venezuela have launched their first direct shipping line as the two countries work to step up cooperation in different fields. This is part of Tehran's efforts to diversify its trade and economic relations in the face of increasing sanctions by the West. The Islamic Republic has been pursuing the policy of expanding relations with a look towards the East in particular, while also aiming to grow trade ties with Africa and Latin America. In tonight's program, we'll discuss the extent to which Iran has been successful in this regard with our guests. Academic and political analyst Bruno Beclini joining us from Porto Alegre, Brazil. We also have journalist, activist, and political analyst John Bosnich joining us from Belgrade.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Start off with Mr. Biclini in Porto Alegre. It's great to have you with us, both of you gentlemen. Mr. Biclini, Iran and Venezuela have launched their first direct shipping line as the two countries work to step up cooperation in different fields. How do you view the significance of such a step?
Well, first of all, it will be a reference for the whole maritime freight and commerce between Latin America and the Islamic Republic. Because it's very difficult, for example, for Brazilian exporters to get maritime freight to Iran. And also, the majority of the major of the bulks and the vessels of the merchant fleet from Iran is more dedicated to the Asian continent. So it's a great notice. Also, it includes a question of security, maritime security, considering that the Atlantic and the South Atlantic, it is the majority of the Navy operating there is Anglo-Saxon, being U.S. or Great Britain Navy. They surrounded the Atlantic Southern Ocean from Latin America to Africa, and this is a great notice, even more because, as far as I know, these bulks will also go through South Africa, increasing the commerce between other BRICS countries like South Africa.
John Bozich, the shipping line has been launched as Iran and Venezuela pledge to boost bilateral ties in various fields. They just signed a 20-year strategic agreement to expand cooperation on energy and agriculture, among other things. Now, both countries, as we know, are under U.S. sanctions and have been looking for alternatives to neutralize that pressure. It looks like the more the U.S. tries to crank up the pressure, the target countries, they manage to come up with more opportunities.
Well, actually, that's the case. During the 1990s, when the United States put sanctions here on Serbia, Serbia developed entire new industries and autonomous production inside the country, eliminating the need for many Western imports. The same thing, of course, has happened with Cuba, and we now hear that Russia is a net agricultural exporter after many decades of having to import agricultural products. So what we're seeing is not just isolated results that are successful, but a blanket response of productivity, autonomy, and independence economically as a result of American sanctions. There is nothing other to say except that these sanctions have backfired and they have united the world against the United States.
Mr. Biclini, the Iranian embassy in Venezuela says that one ship will be sent to Venezuela every 3 months. What kind of a response are you expecting to see from the U.S. in this regard? If you recall back in 2020, when Iran sent oil tankers to Venezuela, Washington had threatened to prevent Venezuela from receiving the ships from Iran. Now, much to the dissatisfaction of the U.S., those ships were received by Venezuela. What about now?
Everything is possible when we think about the so-called hawks living in Washington, D.C. Their capabilities are very, very wide one, and their morality allows them to do everything. Anything is possible and it's unpredictable. But as far as I believe in Latin America capacity of self-defense and autonomous diplomacy, I don't think that Biden administration would dare to do this regarding what is happening now in Argentina, Brazil, Colombia, Chile, Bolivia. We are much more self-determined than we would be 5 years ago or even 3 years ago. It will be a hardcore situation for them, allowing the Sovereign Command, the military combatant commando permanent that they put to project power against us in Latin America, to frighten and to do this, I would say, piracy against Iranian vessels. I don't think they will dare like this, but considering U.S. policies, everything is possible.
Mr. Bosnich, let's look at this in the bigger picture. The Iranian president, Ebrahim Raisi, had promised a more comprehensive, quote-unquote, look to the east. Iran seems to be moving in that very direction. Now, a 25-year strategic agreement was recently signed between Tehran and China. What would a boost in economic, energy, and trade relations between Tehran and Beijing mean?
Obviously, this is going to lead to a greater level of integration in other areas other than just energy. China has a great number of technologies and productive capacities that will be of interest and of great use to Iran. Iran also has its excellent drone technologies and military defense technologies that it is certainly more than willing to share with countries facing similar pressure from the United States. I'd also like to predict right now that the one boat every 3 months is going to become one boat every month with Venezuela. And after the first 2 months, it's going to become one boat every week, because the natural flow of trade between countries under sanctions can only explode exponentially. Because these countries have the right to trade, they have the right under the World Trade Organization to trade, and the United States cannot legally sanction or block trade between two independent countries on the open seas.
Mr. Bosnich, I'm going to stay with you. You mentioned the issue of integration. Iran, as we also know, was recently granted full membership at the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the SCO. How significant is SCO membership of Iran? What are the implications for Iran across the board economically and diplomatically, and what does it mean for Iran to be an SCO member? How can a stronger, what can a stronger SCO do in particular for the region?
Well, let's compare the, let's say, rival economic groupings around the world. We've got the North American Free Trade Agreement, which is basically a resource rape by the United States from Mexico and Canada. Being a Canadian, I know that firsthand. In the EU, we have former colonial powers trying to make a go of it without the resources that they need locally, and they're doing very, very poorly, as we see with the energy crisis and the insanity of blowing up their own fuel lines in cooperation with the United States. So there's no doubt that the SCO is about to become, if not already, the world's single largest and most important economic cooperation organization. And with the increase of economic cooperation, we're going to see cultural, political, and military cooperation to protect their domestic territory and their rights. I'm looking at the SCO as being the major element in the pendulum shift on this planet toward the east.
Mr. Beklini, Iran says that it's expanding relations with the look towards the east in particular, while also eyeing growing trade ties with Africa and with Latin America. How important can these expansions be?
It's a huge importance, because for us, for example, in Brazil, Iran is a middle power, ranked in the same level as Brazil, a little bit more in high tech, a little bit less in agriculture, for example. And we can expect for another situation to our Iranian expanding commerce, trade, and also a kind of soft power on our societies, it will embrace a portion of the elite in Latin America who has Arab descendancy. I insist on this. Only in Brazil, we are 16 million Arab descendants. We have the vice president. We have the Minister of Economy. We have the Minister of Planning. It's not a small thing to deal with. So Iran working in trade in Africa, in Latin America, can embrace a part of the ruling class of those countries to look to the East as a solution to get rid of the U.S. dollar as the international currency and the threats of the sanctions coming from Washington, for example.
And the same question that we had for Mr. Bosnich, I'm going to bring it to you, Mr. Beklini, as well. How do you perceive the functionality of an organization like the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the SCO, with Iran as a member?
It's wonderful. It's a huge challenge because the SCO and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, it can establish a new pattern of international trade. For example, putting in concrete the dream of Lord Keynes of having the bank or an international currency without being connected to a central bank like it was first of all in England during the 19th century and then with the U.S. Federal Bank Service, the Fed. So the SCO can expand the trade between Asia and from Asia to Africa and to Latin America. The most important thing that we must understand in international trade, international system, is that we cannot allow anymore the U.S. to be the police of the world. We cannot allow anymore them to say which country will be inside the SWIFT system and which country will without SWIFT system. We must expand the systems, the banking system, to get rid of U.S. dollar as international currency and to get rid of the SWIFT system. That's the must-be situation.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
John Bosnich, these advancements now at the time of the toughest sanctions ever on Iran have led to Iran becoming more and more self-sufficient. Has a maximum pressure campaign and sanctions regime not been successful?
Well, I mean, unless Iran has its man in Washington who's organizing these sanctions to help Iran become independent, no. The United States is behaving like a bully. And that's what they are. They pretend to be the global policeman, but actually what they are is the global bully. And we know, all of us, from our primary school days in school, that there is usually a bully. And the bully uses his brute force against several weaker people that he finds in his class until he runs into one who is not going to be pushed around. The Americans have run into Russia, they have run into China, and they have now run into Iran. And they are not going to be able to push around neither Russia, nor China, nor Iran. And this is the way the bully is brought into line. And if necessary, this is the way that the bully is brought down.
Mr. Beklini, Tehran, first of all, the issue bringing countries together, which was mentioned by Mr. Bosnich, the Iranian president, Ebrahim Raisi, has stressed that his country's foreign policy, meaning Iran, is based on opposition to unilateralism. Now, what countries like Iran, Russia, China, Venezuela, and a number of other countries they surely have in common is opposition to unilateralism. So are the U.S. sanctions and Washington's enmity actually binding more countries together?
No, of course not. They're trying to subordinate the European Union, and they have succeeded in it, promoting and escalating the war in Ukraine and getting out of the Minsk agreement. And they are also, for example, the Southern Command, they want to put their hands on the lithium in Chile, Argentina, and especially in Bolivia. And Bolivia does have an agreement with China to benefit the lithium and to start, for example, a nuclear energy system for medicine in Bolivia, like what happened in Iran. They will do whatever they can to sabotage the Brazilian diplomatic effort to do peace talks between Ukraine and Russia. And even the comedian, the Zelensky, wants to be in a peace talk between with Brazilian diplomacy between them and Moscow. Washington is desperate to provoke as long as more conflicts as they can do this. For example, in the Pacific Ocean, the permanent example that they are provoking instability in Latin America, they are allowing the coup d'etat in Peru, for example. So I would say that unilateralism only promotes betraying elite ruling class against their own countries and promote even more war and more dissent in the international system.
John Bozich, on another note, Tehran says allegations concerning Iran's nuclear activities and its lack of transparency with the IAEA are a continuation of Washington's destructive policies, i.e. spreading Iranophobia. Is Washington, in your opinion, trying to spin this to justify the lethal and deadly sanctions that affect the people of Iran?
Well, I would go beyond saying that they're spinning this, because when you spin something, it's partially true, and you augment the true part, that minority aspect, and you diminish the majority aspect, which is false. They're not spinning the story against Iran, they're fabricating it. Iran is a signatory to the necessary agreements on nuclear power and nuclear generation. Iran complied with and placed cameras to watch its operations in nuclear purification of the nuclear materials for power generation. Iran invited inspectors, and yet the United States continually maintained the lie that Iran was non-compliant. And they did all of this as if all of us were blind. Because at the very same time, America's only real ally in the Middle East, Israel, is a non-signatory to these control agreements and is already a nuclear power, as the whistleblower Mordecai Vanunu revealed in Israel before they put him away for 18 years in solitary confinement for revealing Israel's illegal nuclear weapons program.
Bruno Buccini, talking about lack of transparency, it's the Israelis who are known as the sole possessor of nuclear weapons in the West Asian region. They enjoy unconditional support from the U.S. They are not signatories to the NPT, as mentioned by Mr. Bozich right now. They do not cooperate with the IAEA. They're believed to have a clandestine atomic weapons program. How dangerous can this lack of transparency be, which is never mentioned by the U.S. and its allies?
We must remember what happened during the 1973 war against the Zionist entity. The former passed by ministry, Minister Golda Meir, she threatened to throw an atomic bomb against the Cairo. The biggest threat against humanity nowadays is the reactor that they do have in Dimona, in the Negev Desert. Colin Powell, also former commander-in-chief of the U.S. forces and passed by also, he said, he written, that the Israeli do have at minimum 200 missiles and ogives, and they maybe do have 300 bombs. So the Zionist entity is the biggest threat to the whole humanity, talking about nuclear energy and nuclear weapons. And I would like to think so that, can we imagine Cuba reinstalling nuclear missiles in the island? What Washington would do nowadays? But they are threatening to install nuclear missiles around the Ukrainian frontier, for example, or even more inside from Ukraine. They would like to do this. So I would say that Israeli atomic bombs and atomic program is the open secret of the whole world. And the hypocrisy of the Western societies and the Western media, they are denying the facts and also putting the finger against Iran and other middle powers that only want to be sovereign and self-determined countries and societies.
Sure. John Bozich, on the Israeli nuclear weapons, the Iranian foreign ministry has said this is an outstanding example of hypocrisy, dual standards, and discriminatory policies of various U.S. administrations. How has this hypocrisy been ignored and overlooked?
Well, first of all, you're right, it's hypocrisy, and that's hypocrisy with a capital H, as in hydrogen bomb, not just nuclear weapons. The Israeli military program for nuclear weapons includes hydrogen bombs. That means the maximum nuclear capacity that exists. And this is not a rumor, it's not an allegation, it is a proven fact, because scientist Mordecai Vanunu, an Israeli nuclear scientist, revealed this and broke this story in Europe on the run, and he was kidnapped by Israeli military intelligence and taken back to Israel, where he was tried and convicted to 18 years to life in prison. And he was not allowed to meet with, speak to anybody for literally two decades. So that is not what you do with somebody who tells a rumor. Israel is a leading international nuclear power. That's the fact of the matter. The situation now is that America cannot continue to lie about this, and it cannot continue to have a double standard toward Iran unless it wants to cut itself off from the entire world. And that's what it looks like America is doing, step by step, backwards to their little territory.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. That's all the time we have for tonight's show. Academic and political analyst Bruno Beclini joining us from Porto Alegre, Brazil. And journalists, activists, and political analyst John Bozic joining us from Belgrade. Also, special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight. It's good night for now.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
A group of Zionist settlers who were backed by the regime's forces attacked a village near the city of Nablus in the northern part of the occupied West Bank, shooting dead a Palestinian man. The Palestinian Health Ministry identified the victim as 37-year-old Sameh Hamdullah Mahmoud Akhtash, saying the fatality was caused recently after Zionist settlers and forces attacked the village of Za'atare south of the city of Nablus, shooting the Palestinian man in the abdomen, the official Palestinian Wafa news agency had reported. Hundreds of Palestinians were also injured during the attacks by the Zionist settlers and troops on Nablus area towns and villages on the same day. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Kayhan International wrote in this regard, "More violence and more bloodshed has gripped the environs of the city of Nablus in the West Bank region of River Jordan in the usurped land of Palestine as bands of illegal Zionist migrants backed by the terroristic armed forces of Israel continued their terrorizing of the sons of the soil following green light to commit more crimes given by a meeting of Israelis, Americans, and Arab traitors in the Jordanian port city of Aqaba. Recently, scores of homes and cars were torched in the town of Hawara, and a Palestinian man martyred by gunfire by the thugs of mostly American origin as the UN turned a blind eye and the treacherous Arab regimes, while hypocritically calling for a halt to the conflagration wish for worsening of the plight of Palestinians." This is the pathetic situation of the usurped land of Palestine, which for the past 75 years has not seen any peace and has no hopes of ever seeing peace, as it reels under the jackboots of the Israelis, who have now been given the license by the UAE, Bahrain, Egypt, and other pro-Zionist Arab regimes to ground Palestinians into dust. In such an atmosphere of hopelessness, the only hope is in the indomitable spirit of Palestinian youths to carry out more daring operations against the terrorist entity which barely a week ago brutally martyred at least a dozen Palestinians in Nablus. Last Sunday, two illegal Zionist migrants were shot dead by youth of the resistance forces, to the horror of Israel and its godfathers in Washington and London, who are trying in vain to prolong its precarious existence as a terror base of the West against the Muslim world. The operation took place south of Nablus in the town of Hawara when a car of illegal Zionist migrants was targeted by a Palestinian freedom fighter. The popular Palestinian liberation movements of Hamas and Islamic Jihad have expressed their strong support for the heroic operation, describing it as a natural reaction to the Zionist regime's crimes against Palestinians, the most recent of which was the deadly raid in Nablus. According to Islamic Jihad, the operation was carried out in line with the promise of vengeance for the blood of Palestinian resistance fighters recently martyred by Zionist forces in Nablus. This sends a strong message to the illegal Zionist entity and its backers that the Palestinians, despite the genocide of the past seven decades, are determined to liberate their usurped homeland, which means the recent rampage by terrorist gangs of illegal Zionist migrants in Hawara will be definitely retaliated. The fabricated regime of Israel is a cancerous tumor and ought to be removed from the body politic of Palestine at any cost. The whole resistance movement is with the oppressed people of Palestine and will provide every possible means of support in the struggle to end the illegal existence of the Zionist entity. Beit al-Muqaddas is sacred to the Ummah, and this warrants the stepping of the armed struggle on a greater scale against both the illegal Zionist migrants and the armed forces of the Zionist regime. The whole Muslim world, including people living in the reactionary Arab states, fully back the Palestinians and wish success in their endeavors against the occupiers and usurpers of their homeland. To sum up, no conspiracy by the West or their clients in the Arab world in the form of meetings and so-called peace negotiations will ever succeed in killing the Palestinian cause. Meanwhile, Palestine Chronicle noted, a student activist of Palestinian universities in the besieged Gaza Strip organized a rally recently to protest against the recent attacks carried out by illegal Zionist settlers in the occupied West Bank. The participants also rejected the decision by the Palestinian Authority to take part in a U.S.-brokered summit with Zionist regime's officials in the Jordanian town of Aqaba. The students held banners in rejection of the so-called security coordination between the PA and the fabricated regime of Israel, and they burned pictures of the far-right Israeli National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir. Meanwhile, national and Islamic political movements, along with academics, clerics, and representatives of civil society, organized a popular conference to declare their opposition to the security meeting in Aqaba and the decision of Palestinian Authority to take part in it. The conference articulated a detailed policy platform. The Aqaba meeting has no legitimacy among the Palestinian people. Resistance to the brutal Israeli occupation is a legitimate right for the Palestinian people in all of its forms. The Israeli occupation must stop provoking Palestinians in Al-Quds and in the occupied West Bank, and the international community bears full responsibility for covering up the Israeli occupation's crimes against the Palestinian people.